Good morning. This is Hour of the Wolf, a often weekly program dedicated to science fiction, fantasy, enchantment, and, the imagination. My name is Jim Freund. He was with us for the first book. Well, he's with us for the second. Rajan Khanna will be joining us. You gotta stay tuned. Good morning. I'm going to rearrange things so I can see my guests. There we are. Hope you all enjoyed that, those of you who are watching on your radios. And again, good morning. This is Hour of the Wolf. We do not have a movie review this week. Dan Persons is taking another week off for various reasons. Should be back soon. And let's see, announcements. Yeah, turn your Wayback Machine, 8 hours ago, and you would have heard Robert Levy and Kathy Koja at the KGB Fantastic Fiction Reading Series. But I did dutifully announce them last week. So the next thing to point out is the New York Review of Science Fiction Reading Series in the very building, about 40 feet below us. There are fortunately floors between. But at the Brooklyn Commons, 388 Atlantic Avenue, and it's December. And that means that we only have couples, families performing. That's been a tradition with us for about 11 or 12 years. And the family of choice is, as always, Ellen Kushner and Delia Sherman, who are coincidentally two of the niftier, better writers about, and always come up with wonderful surprises for the December reading. 2 years ago, a complete audiobook performed from sections of the Riverside series under the Neil Gaiman Presents umbrella. And we had some real audiobook stars at that event. And then last year, which was actually, was that our first event here at 388 Atlantic? It might have been. No, we had Walter Mosley 3 months before that. And then we had Ellen and Delia. And whereupon, right after Delia read a story, Ellen decided that people had to do some round singing, because it was mentioned in Delia's book, which is, by the way, just out. And she'll tell you more about that in a couple of weeks. December 8th at 388 Atlantic Avenue. Admission is free. And hope that you will join us. And we have a guest host who wishes to remain nameless. And so she shall. Spoiler. But no, it's not a secret or anything. There are some people who, professional reasons, they have real lives out there, don't want it to be known that they do this science fiction stuff. So let's see. There's that announcement. Friday, starting Friday, on Amazon Prime, the entire first season of The Man in the High Castle. Which, Raj, did you see episode one?
I haven't, actually. I haven't seen it yet, but I'm looking forward to it.
Whoops. Hold on. For some reason, do me a favor. Tap your microphone. No, that's not doing it.
Should I move over?
No. Try it again. Ah, ha, ha, ha. It's just this little chromium switch here. Apparently, I have to press a button down on the console, which there's no manual for this room, none whatsoever, other than there's a sign outside the door that says, be quiet, because there's no soundproofing as well, and that is the current.
Fly by the seat of your pants.
Yeah, very much so, and I would say state of WBAI, but it's really more a small municipality, even if we do broadcast at 50,000 watts. But I was very pleased to see that they did not try to simply bring Philip K. Dick to the screen. And, yeah, it's produced or co-produced by Ridley Scott. And unlike some people who Raj knows, I am not a big Blade Runner fan. Precisely for the reason that, well, I not only far prefer the book, but the movie totally contradicts the book in a number of ways. Blade Runner and Do Androids Dream of Electric Sheep use the same character names, and they conflict, and they even conflict within the bounds of the movie, but that's another show, another time, and I've done at least two shows on that topic with Matt.
Right.
And with Edward Einhorn, who did a very good a theatrical adaptation of Do Androids Dream of Electric Sheep. And so it was a really fun show to have Matt Kressel, who lives and breathes Blade Runner. I figured out why. Why is Blade Runner his favorite movie and 2001 mine? Is because we were each 12 years old when we saw it.
Huh.
How's that for a theory?
That's interesting. Now I'm trying to think.
I have to pose that to Matt. I haven't.
Yeah. I wonder what I saw when I was 12. I can't think of it.
Yeah.
I'm sure I saw a few movies, so I'd have to figure out.
Yeah, but an iconic science fiction film that would have been the one to possibly turn you. And I think that might have been it, because I was certainly either 12 or 13 when I saw 2001 in Cinerama.
Wow. That's an amazing movie.
And, I still, you know, put it all the way up there. Blade Runner's beautiful.
Sure.
Beautiful. But its plot... Well, you can hear the sirens are coming right now. So Ridley Scott co-produces The Man in the High Castle, and I thought that the pilot was very good, and it had, like Blade Runner, had nothing to do with Android's Dream of Electric Sheep. This TV series has little to do so far with The Man in the High Castle. except that it takes place in the same universe. But the characters are different.
Interesting.
And Man in the High Castle, I do not think, is the best Philip K. Dick book. But I think it's one of the best alternate history novels ever written. And it's a good Philip K. Dick book. So taking the universe and setting a TV series in that alternate universe that Dick built, that's shrewd. And there's a lot of commonality between them. So it opens, everybody's saying, wait a minute, the last episode was 10 months ago, and now there's the next. And it's like, yes, that one was called The Pilot. And in today's world of streaming, and I'm shocked at how many people on social media like Facebook don't get it. Every episode will be available this Friday, you know, so you can binge watch or something. I usually do like, you know, an episode every second night or something like that. I like doing it. I don't like binging, although okay, except for two-parters.
Right.
So
that is an interesting thing, because it used to be two-parters, you'd have to wait for a week, but now usually you can see it like right after.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Yeah, Doctor Who, which is almost all two-parters this year, okay, with last week's episode being the only one this season that wasn't part of a two-parter, and then it goes right back to it. And by the way, I don't know if people caught it, but the episode before last, the second two-parter, the inversion of the Zygons, first was Invasion of the Zygons, and inversion was one of the best episodes. There was an anti-war speech made by Peter Capaldi, playing the Doctor in there, that is just magnificent. Go to YouTube and look it up, because everybody has excerpted it and putting French symbols around it and stuff like that, because it is horribly prescient. So let's see. Any other announcements do I have to make? Probably, yes. What I thought was the best science fiction TV series of this year, Mr. Robot, is having a marathon coming up, and check your schedules, and it's probably available on demand. So this is like this small little thing that came out of USA Network, you know, in between like Desperate Kardashians or some and stuff like that, and it's really, really good. And don't read articles about it, because they're filled with spoilers. Just go into it blind and watch it through. And by the end, by the last episode, and it's 13 episodes long, it's amazing. And they're coming back for a season 2, which they had planned. And where that's going to go will be interesting, because I will tell you this one thing. At the 13th episode of season 1, the entire world changes. So, have you seen any of that?
I haven't. I'm so behind. I mean, I've heard great things about that and a few other shows. And, I mean, I feel like every time I sit down to watch something, I watch a television show more than a movie. You know, like I'll punch up Netflix or something like that. But I think with writing the book, I got so behind. So, I'm still catching up on things. And I have a job, yeah.
Little things like that. And you occasionally do radio shows at 1:30 in the morning.
But yeah, that's on my list, along with a number of other shows that have been highly recommended.
Yeah, and just don't read articles about season 2.
Okay.
Because articles about season 2 will give away some very interesting stuff that, you know, I don't necessarily believe in spoilers. They don't spoil it. But there are things that are, who was it? Michael Bishop, in an interview I did with him, talking about his baseball science fiction novel, in which it's clear that one of the characters, a scout, is semi-immortal, but we don't know why. But we know that from the beginning. And he said, yeah, well, let's not say too much because it's nice when people find the reveal for themselves. And I thought, ooh, what a lovely word, the reveal.
The reveal. Yeah. I mean, I think
and that's really what it is. It's
that is the tricky thing about the way that you can, you know, Netflix will release one season all at once and the next day people can talk about the whole season as a whole of the people who stay up and watch it. And so it can be tricky to avoid that. So I always feel this pressure to watch things, but then I don't have the time. And so at some point in time, I think you have to just.
And I want to watch on my own schedule.
Yeah.
People are saying, oh, such and such a show is so great. And it's like, okay, you know, right now I'm following so many things. And I don't have, I'll get to that. Because another nice thing about Netflix and Amazon Prime and all of these streaming services is that not only can you watch it on your own time, but you can wait till you're darn ready.
Right.
And watch two episodes one night and then wait for a month. I've only started watching Person of Interest.
Okay, yeah.
Which is entering its fifth season. And I'm nearing the end of season one. And that's fine by me. And I've been watching it for a month.
Yeah. Yeah, I think it's kind of nice sometimes when, like, I think like everyone else, I didn't watch The Wire when it was on, but I watched it later. Mm-hmm. And occasionally you run into somebody who says, oh, I just started The Wire.
And that's one that has reveals, yeah.
Yeah, but you know, I get excited because I'm like, oh, this is so great. You know, like, what season are you in? And, like, you know, just imagining what they have waiting for them and, you know, some of the heartbreak and things like that. But I guess you can kind of relive it, too, through other people who come to a show later. But I watch Walking Dead, and that's a hard one because, you know, even if you avoid spoilers.
That's who dies this week.
Yeah, it's like, oh, my God, something happened last night or somebody died. And you know, I guess it doesn't completely spoil it.
Game of Thrones? Ned? No. And I don't watch Game of Thrones, but, you know. Or rather, I stopped just before Ned bought it.
Apologies to those who haven't seen Game of Thrones yet.
Well, I mean, that one is how many years old?
Right, I know.
Not to mention the fact kidding. That and I was so amazed at all the people that were going, how could they do that? Well, because the book on which it's based, it came out 4 years ago, already, you know, gave that one away.
What I think is interesting about Game of Thrones is that I feel like the people who have read the books and who are ahead of, or up until recently were ahead of those who were watching the show, they didn't spoil it because I think it, you know, some people gave them a little, but I think it gave some people almost a smug feeling to be like, I know what's going to happen and I can't wait until you lose your mind when this horrible thing happens in the TV show. But
you see, they've been pulling a double whammy on that.
Yeah.
They have the TV show now deviating from the books to an extent,
right,
where somebody who dies in book two doesn't die until book four,
right,
or something like that, or maybe doesn't die.
Yeah, which I thought was really interesting because at one point in time it looked like they were going to almost become two separate entities, and I thought to myself, you know, if he still is working on finishing the last books and they need to go ahead, like what if they just made their own?
And George is working on other projects.
Right. Right, to the frustration of all of his fans out there. But
yeah, well, I saw a video clip somewhere where Neil Gaiman had been introducing George Martin at World Fantasy or something like that, or actually something even bigger, and where George is about to say hello to the audience. And people were screaming, where's book six or whatever? And Gaiman took the microphone back. And he said, people, get one thing straight. HBO, George is not HBO's bitch. Which I thought was pretty crude. But also,
yeah.
Good for them.
Yeah.
And Gaiman's got some. Well, actually, American Gods is going to be the next big thing on HBO, but not anymore. Now, Stars.
Stars.
Stars has picked up American Gods. And the reason I have to mention, I don't watch Game of Thrones. I'm a big George Martin fan. But I do not care to watch visceral gore.
Mm.
And I'll be talking about it more next week, and I know exactly what I'll be saying because I recorded it yesterday with Randy Dawn, who will be the guest. And I was talking about how they calculate when, yes, I know when to look away, but they know when I know to look away and calculate. And then it's like, yes, okay, fine, there was a courtyard fight. The sword gets this guy in the neck. I looked away. I didn't need to see the close-up of that. So fine, the fight is over. We'll see the corpses. But instead, what we see is they then cut back to a close-up of the neck with arterial spurting and gushing while you see the artery actually spurt. And it's like, okay, you know what? That's not entertainment for me.
Yeah, I get that.
I'd rather read the recaps. Yeah, a lot of people don't get that. But they're younger.
They're more conditioned to it, I suppose.
They're more conditioned. They grew up with the splatter films of the 80s. That's what I think.
Yeah.
You know, they're Wes Craven creations. What they are, so they see all the comedy in Wes Craven, which there is,
sure,
and for them, Cabin in the Woods is nothing. It's slapstick comedy, which it is. I get that. I won't watch it.
I do think that there's this trend to, like, everything, a lot, or not everything, but a lot of the dramas seem to be going darker these days. And that stuff doesn't usually bother me, but when I watch five different shows where it's violent and dark and depressing, you know, it adds up after a while. And I find myself trying to search out more comedies lately just to kind of break it up and give my mind a palate cleanser for a while. So.
And it's been hard for me on TV. It's been hard for me. I grew up on sitcoms, and I somehow just fell off the sitcom shelf. I watched Seinfeld for only half a season and stopped.
Oh yeah,
I'll stick with The Simpsons, thank you. but that's not a sitcom; that's another world.
Yeah,
the graining world. And I did watch on Netflix, speaking of which, The Unbreakable Kimmy Schmidt.
Oh right, yeah, me too.
And for the most part, I liked that.
Yeah,
for the most part. And that was written for network TV. Huh. So it'll be very interesting to see. And then it sold to Netflix. So it'll be very interesting to see where the second season, which is created for Netflix, and all bets are off, and we're in cable rules not, which is basically there are none,
yeah,
where they're going to go with that particular show. And it's still going to be Tina Fey and crew, so they're going to adhere to certain standards.
Right.
But it'll be curious. Tell us more about your own work. Let's get back on topic here. First of all, I mispronounced your name, as I always do. I call you Raj.
You're right. Most people do.
So it's Rajan.
Rajan. Carmen.
And yet, for some reason, when I see Rajan, Rajan... For some, it parses incorrectly.
That's the way I would say 95% of the people I meet say it. Where I work, I use my full name, and so everyone uses a variation of that. It's what can you do? You know, I'm not going to spend my time going around correcting everyone, right? So,
so you stick to Raj.
Yeah, that's usually the easiest way to avoid any problems on both sides.
Yeah, so. But I know a number of people I've called Raj whose full names are Roger.
Oh, right, yeah. Yeah.
And they can be Raj. That's Raj.
Yeah, when I was younger and I would go by Raj, the association people had was What's Happening, because his name was Roger, the character Roger, and everyone called him Raj. And like, what's happening, Raj? And so that was the nearest association for most people.
Yeah. And where did you grow up?
I grew up in New Jersey, suburban Joyce. New Jersey. Yeah.
What part?
A town called Livingston, so kind of north central Jersey.
Good birding there. That's how I know it. There are actually parks nearby.
Yeah.
Yeah, where one can go birding. And
I've never done that. I've never birded in New Jersey, but yeah.
Boided in central Jersey. You don't go birding, you're boiding. I worked at Liberty Science Center for several years, and oh my God, the accents were right out of The Sopranos. I thought that was made up. I thought the Bronx was bad.
Yeah.
But Joyzy. Oh my God, Joyzy.
Yeah.
You don't have that sound.
Thank you. no, I shouldn't say that. I mean, I still have family there, and it is interesting because you know, or at least I know when I'm in Jersey or somebody's from Jersey just based on the way they pronounce things, but it's not that different.
I should have had a Queens accent.
Yeah.
Because I grew up in Queens and now I'm in Brooklyn. So I tell people, well, I was born in Queens, but now I'm in Brooklyn. but I don't really have either. And I'm first generation American.
Oh, wow.
So, German Jewish parents who not to my ears, but to everybody else's ears, had an accent.
So you didn't have to train yourself to be on the radio to have a more mid-Atlantic accent or anything?
At BAI. And also, I started when I was 13.
That's right.
The formative years where that was happening. When Margot Adler started Hour of the Wolf in 1972, I'd already been working on editing radio, spoken word radio, for Baird Searles. And started with Samuel R. Delaney at practice. My editings did not make it into the final cut of The Star Pit, which is what Chip was doing at the time. But I learned on a duplicate copy.
Wow.
And I started doing readings, like, by the time I was 14 or 15. And when Hour of the Wolf began in 72, so I would have been 19 or so, Margot was doing readings with her fabulous voice, and I wanted in.
Right.
And she was like, well, okay, it's 5 a.m., nobody will notice. And I wasn't bad, and she actually said, that wasn't bad, Freund. So, so I've been doing, and we called it narrating, which is something that you do. That's something that's really only started becoming an industry in the last, under 10 years.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I think I was always, like, I remember being younger and they would have audiobooks at the Walden Books where I used to shop for my books. And
but
I
they called those people readers.
Right, okay. That's true.
Huh, they didn't call them narrators. Yeah. That's a new thing.
Interesting.
And on the job that I stole from you, actually, that you gave up and I got, which is editor of audio editor, post-production person, they call it, of Lightspeed Magazine and Nightmare Magazine. Now that I'm host of Lightspeed Magazine, in the intro, I refer to the person as the narrator, and in the outro, I refer to them as the reader.
Huh.
I have it both ways. To me, it's a reader. Was it read for you by, not narrated for you.
Right. Yeah, that's interesting. I never really stopped to think about that.
But there are people who, including the people who narrate for Lightspeed Magazine, who are their narrators.
Right. But I think
on your resume, it says narrator.
Well, I think the reason for that, though, is that, especially when you're coming up and nobody knows who you are and you say in your bio, I'm a reader, I think it's the assumption from some people is that, oh, he reads books too. Why did he have to put that in his bio, Whereas narrator, at least, is more descriptive of that you've done this for some medium, I suppose.
You know, I never thought about that, but that's,
but I
makes
mean,
that makes a lot of sense.
If actually. I were reading something and somebody referred to me as the reader, I would not have a problem with that.
Obviously. Yeah, I just say, you know, read for you by.
Right, right. Because that's what you're doing. You're reading out loud.
Absolutely, yeah. Absolutely. Oh, and I should mention that we will be doing our annual Tolkien broadcast, Read for You by Baird Searles, from 1972, produced by myself, David Marks, and Margot Adler in 1972, with help from Professor J.R.R. Tolkien. We called him up and got pronunciations. I have to tell this story. I was on the phone with Tolkien maybe 10 seconds.
Wow.
But I have to tell people that, yes, I've spoken to Tolkien. Just to get a pronunciation.
I've probably spoken to him too, but I don't think he spoke back. So.
No. Yeah, well, yes, there's that. No, I got him. It was a practical, well, sort of a practical. Baird gave me a phone number. And he said, call this number. It's in England. It's a guy at Oxford University. And I want you to ask him, how do you properly pronounce G-A-N-D-A-L-F?
And what did he say?
And Tolkien, and he didn't tell me who I was calling, but became clear instantly. And, rough voice, bit South African, bit Oxford, and he says, Gandalf. And it's like, okay, that could have been anything given the British accent. So I said, what would that rhyme with? He said, well, like half a sixpence. Uh-huh. Half. Gandalf. But he pronounced the L. You could hear the L. And when he said half, he said sort of half a sixpence. I can't quite do it.
Wow.
But that's it. The F should be a little V-like. Gandalf. But it's not Alf.
Right.
According to the professor. But who knows what the accents in Middle Earth are like. So, and he came from the Second Age. It might be... Actually, he came from the First Age, didn't he? Being one of the Valar.
Oh, right, yeah.
Yes, I can get into this way more than any human being should. I cut the line. I don't speak. Actually, I do speak a little Elvish.
Nice.
I used to. Well, I memorized some of the poems, is all.
Oh, wow.
It'll be the Saturday before Christmas.
Okay.
It's an annual event. It's the Council of Elrond being book 2, chapter 2 of volume 1 of the novel Lord of the Rings, which was always intended to be published in, as a book 2. Fellowship of the Ring has 2 books in it. And it's book 2. And that one's called The Council of Elrond. And it's the only part of Lord of the Rings that's self-contained.
Yeah.
Because that's where everybody meets.
That's one of my favorite scenes.
And and it's 3 minutes long in the movie.
Yeah, true.
Although, to be fair, what Jackson does is he just unfolds it. We get most of the scenes that are in The Council of Elrond, but in the book they're flashback.
Yeah. My favorite thing about the film version is I feel like Boromir comes alive for me in a way that I never experienced when I was reading it.
But same actor. I'm getting confused here.
Right.
Wait, they both die. But spoilers. Sorry, go on.
No, I thought that was well done because, you know, I think...
He was brilliantly done.
Yeah.
He was brilliantly portrayed. There's a lot... There are nitpicks to make about that movie, and there's a lot to praise.
Sure. And I think he was more sympathetic in that film than I'd ever experienced. And, I mean, obviously, I read the book so many times, but and I always saw Boromir as a sympathetic character, but it was sold for me much better by Sean Bean
Jackson and Bean did an amazing job with Boromir and Faramir and their father and all that, beautifully rendered, beautifully done. I was expecting a little bit better on the funeral, though.
Yeah.
Which Tolkien...
I can agree there, yeah.
...brings. And my two main complaints, and then we'll get back to you, about Lord of the Rings are, one, that one has to forgive Jackson for, and that's no Tom Bombadil.
Oh, right.
But why not have a Tom Bombadil movie? There's enough material, including in the Silmarillion.
Right.
I mean, God knows they mined the Silmarillion in order to pad out The Hobbit beyond recognition, Mr. Del Toro. He's the one who did that.
Oh.
Del Toro wrote The Hobbit as two movies. Well, let me just go back to Lord of the Rings. The other thing that I miss, and I really miss, that one feels should have been there is, no, Christopher Lee, Saruman, does, and yes, it's Saruman, does not die in Lord of the Rings. He, with Wormtongue, he goes and he takes over the Shire.
Right.
And when the hobbits get back, after experiencing the war in the long anticlimax, it is the final book of after the ring has been destroyed, they discover, and this is one of the main reasons why Tolkien wrote the book, that industrialization, the evil of industrialization and war, the knowledge of war, have come to the Shire.
Right.
And this, and Tolkien had been through World War I. His if he had a message, which he didn't really, but if he had a message, it was, if you're in this lovely little Arcadian village, if you just sit around and do nothing, war will come to you. And industrialization will come to these, you know, your life will not be as it is.
Yeah, I do like that part too, just how you know, they finally come home and you see how it's kind of reached out to this little small place that up until then was untouched.
And yeah, and in the book it's called The Scouring.
The Scouring of the Shire.
The Scouring of the Shire. Yeah. And that's one thing that I miss from the movie. And yet I can understand why. They want closure.
I mean, Return of the King had 15 endings already, so why not add another one?
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Or, again, even yet something else. The Hobbit, and I'll do this very briefly. The Hobbit was written by Guillermo del Toro. And del Toro wrote two movies. The first movie was There and Back Again and told the story that is recounted from beginning to end in the book The Hobbit. Movie number two was the story of the creation of Sauron, from the necromancer to Sauron, and had the evil orc in it and all that. And that, and if you think about it, it makes a lot of sense. And that's all mined from the Silmarillion,
right,
and appendices and other sources and notes of Tolkien's. That was not made up. And then Del Toro had to leave the project because he was contractually committed to other things, and Jackson was busy making King Kong and The Bones and things he shouldn't have been wasting his time on. And because if he was going to do The Hobbit, then he had a responsibility. Yeah, we don't have windows, but we also don't have a ceiling, so people can just sort of like, you know, peek in at you and wave hi. I think it's wonderful. It's so homey. Just come in. Hello, Lister. Yes, he's not reading yet. So if he were, I wouldn't be. But I'm wasting his time because I want him to read. Lister, you should remember Raj.
Yes.
You've met before, I believe.
Wonderful to see you. Welcome back.
Yeah. So what Jackson does with scripts and his co-workers, they unravel. They take things like the Council of Elrond and they tell the story linear. And that's what he does, is he took the second movie and he added and padded.
Very much padded.
Padded, so that you have this 9 or 10 hour unwatchable thing, despite great casting, unwatchable.
Yeah.
I'm just glad when it's over. I can watch Lord of the Rings over and over. Hobbit, no, thank you.
Yeah, I didn't actually finish the series. I watched the first two, and
the third one has moments.
Yeah.
It has very good moments, you know. It's, you know, Benedict Cumberbatch as Smaug, that works.
Right.
So, at any rate, writing, when did you start? I know that we asked you a lot of these questions last time you were here. What is that, about a year and a half ago?
When I was here, I guess.
And here would have been there, but.
Oh, yeah, it was in the other location. It was probably about a little over a year ago, I think, or maybe it was about
when
a year.
Fallen Skies.
Yeah, Falling Sky came out in October of last year, so it had to have been about that time. So it's been about a year.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Very good.
Yeah.
So I'm asking you questions I asked then, but I don't think all the listeners of this moment heard that show. So.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting because I'm not one of those people who started writing when I was a kid. I was always interested in storytelling. The first story I remember actually writing that had a beginning and an end, and it was based on my D&D playing at the time, was in eighth grade, so I must have been about 13. But I was always, you know, whether it was playing with my Star Wars toys or G.I. Joe toys, or later on when I started playing D&D and you know, creating characters and telling their stories, I think that was when I kind of caught the bug for putting together these long, epic stories with, you know, I started out playing D&D the traditional way with my friends, where you roll the dice and you use the module, and then a friend of mine
and did you have a proper dungeon master?
Yeah, but I mean, what
you
I think
didn't
when
play?
Yes.
Okay, good.
When I was...
It's the only proper way.
Right, and when I first started out, there were groups of us that would play, but eventually it became just me and this other kid who was a couple years older than me. And so we didn't have a group, and what we ended up doing is getting rid of the dice, and we would just take these characters that we had created and tell each other the stories that were going on behind
Ooh.
The scenes.
Right.
So, you know, and of course it went from, oh, I'm a first level fighter, to I'm the king of my own country, and this is what's, and so it became this kind of thing where back and forth we had these characters that were sort of related in geography.
But you're doing proper, I should say, proper. You're doing non-electronic RPG role-playing games.
Right, exactly.
As opposed to people who've come into the field like Nora Jemison from electronic
right.
games. She and Tempest Bradford
right.
Came from electronic games into the field.
I mean, I do like electronic games, but yeah, this was the tabletop pen and paper. And, you know,
hexagon.
Right. But yeah, we started just telling each other these stories, and it was, you know, D&D, and it was also, you know, we went into superhero stuff. And I think that was where I started, you know, putting together not just stories, but characters and worlds and fleshing these things out. And so then when I was assigned, you know, in English class, write a story, that was the first time I'd done it. And I really was not diligent about keeping up with that for many years. And it wasn't until probably my mid to late 20s that I actually decided to try to do it, you know, more often and focus on it. And it was mostly, like, that was, there wasn't a lot of information out there that was readily available. You know, it wasn't like the internet now where you can Google things and something just comes up. So, you know, it was figuring out, you know, how do you submit something to a magazine? And I think I remember a moment where I thought, okay, I had a copy of Asimov's magazine. It had the instructions for how to submit there. Mm-hmm. And I bought a book on you know, writing. And so I figured I'm going to finish something.
There was a magazine in those days, which I assume is still around, Writer's Digest.
Right.
That usually had decent summaries of guidelines.
Right. So, yeah, I mean...
But you couldn't find out that blah, blah, blah is opening for submissions for 3 weeks.
Right. Yeah, I guess it was... I think I was working at Barnes & Noble at the time, so, like, they had a writing section or a reference section that had writing books in it, and, you know, there was an Orson Scott Card book, How to Write Science Fiction.
I think it was a good book.
Right.
So isn't it the craft of writing science fiction?
I don't remember the exact title, but I picked up
whatever that. One thinks about Mr. Card's politics, he knows how to write science fiction,
right.
And he knows how to teach the craft.
And what's interesting about that book specifically is one of the examples he uses, or the one that sticks in my mind, was Octavia Butler.
Mm-hmm.
So that, like, before I had ever read Octavia Butler, I'd read about her writing through this book. But so I was cobbling together all these different things, and as a lot of beginning writers have problems with, I would start a lot of things because I had a lot of ideas, but I couldn't finish them, or I wouldn't finish them. I'd just leave them kind of halfway through. And so I, at some point in time, I just told myself, okay, you have to, if this is something you really want to see if you can do, you have to finish something and you have to send it in. And so I finished something. It was really long. It was really awful. And I sent it to Asimov's, and I got a rejection, but that started me, you know, it's like...
Did you get a slip, or did you get something written?
I don't recall. It was probably just a slip. I don't remember how they did things back then.
I used to punch slips for Galaxy magazine.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, for Jim Bain when he was editor.
But I think it was going through the process and realizing, oh, you know, even though it was disappointing, it was doable. So that, you know, became the snowball rolling downhill.
Mm.
And so, you know, that slowly led to today. And obviously, hopefully I've gotten better in the intervening years.
Oh, now you have an agent.
Right.
You know, that you don't have to worry as much about markets or anything like that. You have a top agent.
Well, it's, I mean, you know, still agents focus on novel-length stuff and not always on short fiction.
Well, there's, so. Yes, 10%, since I used to work for Actors Agency, and in those days it was 10%. Now I assume most agencies are 15.
15,
yeah.
Right.
10% of nothing is nothing.
Right.
So you don't send your actor out to that off-Broadway showcase.
Right.
Unless you're sure that person's going to get a few commercials
right.
out of having been seen in that showcase.
And actually,
and
yeah.
it's the same thing in... And short stories take as much, almost as much time to hone and shape, craft, just... They're very, very meticulous compared to novels.
Yeah, I think, you know, I have two novels out now, and I'm still trying to perfect my understanding of you know, how to craft
called
a short
Fallen
story.
Fallen Sky and Rising Tide.
Yep, those
we
are the
just
two.
Need to mention that every so often.
And
the last name is spelled K-H-A-N-N-A, so people know, you know, what to Google up.
Thank you, Jim.
or Amazon up, or Barnes & Noble up, or whatever.
Yeah.
Powell them up. That's a good one.
That is a good one.
Yeah.
I still haven't made it there in person with you know, in any kind of author capacity. I've been there as a shopper.
Well, yeah, because you haven't traveled at all in the last few weeks. you went to World Fantasy. You were in Ireland. Somewhere else?
California.
Yeah, California. Yeah.
Yeah, the last 2 weeks have been a bit of a whirlwind.
And then the culmination of it all, WBAI.
Yeah.
Brooklyn.
Back home in Brooklyn.
Yeah.
So it's an ever-evolving process, I would say, the whole, you know, writing. And I'm still not as diligent about sitting down to do it as often as I should be. So.
But you also have a life.
Yeah, and that's the tricky thing. But I think, you know, I feel like my routine gets shaken up every few months, so it's still trying to figure out where the writing fits. For a while, I was working from home, and so it was easy to kind of get up in the morning before I had to log in and get an hour. I'm not a morning person, but I find that if I sit down in front of the computer with a cup of coffee before my brain has had time to make up excuses, I can get some great writing done.
I am a morning person. I usually fall asleep in the morning. I'm awake until the morning.
Right. But like now I leave really early for work. Or not really early, but I get up early and leave early. So, you know, and it's always tricky in the evening because there are social activities and my work is exhausting. So it's just trying to find that. And I know this sounds like me whining about stuff, and a lot of writers are very disciplined about doing this, but
Well, the reality of being a science fiction writer, and when I say science fiction, we're using the broad phrase, is that it's mid-list writing. You're not going to be making a living at it.
Right. Yeah, I mean,
I wonder what percentage of members of Science Fiction Writers of America make a living writing.
Yeah, that's a good question. I mean, obviously, you know, I wouldn't say no if
that was... high as... It's certainly under 20%.
Yeah.
Probably, possibly under 10. Because, how much can people earn on their books? There are a few people who can do it, you know, and they're all named Swanwick or Stephen King, you know.
Right. Yeah. I mean, but it's amazing because this second book that came out, I mean, it didn't quite happen in this short a period, but the majority of the writing of it happened within 3 months. So, and I think that just happens because, you know, when you're in it and you have a deadline, and I missed my first deadline, but basically, I would come home and every day I would be like, okay, I have to work on the novel. I have to work on the novel. And so I think there's also the push and pull of that, you know, spending so much time where, you know, I felt guilty for doing anything outside of working on it. So now, you know, now that there's a bit of a lull, I think the tendency is to kind of recharge a bit and not worry about it. But, you know, I have a third book that I want to get done, so
yeah.
I'm gearing up for that now. And I mean, you know, it's interesting.
And are you doing any short stories during this?
Yeah, you know,
because my partner, what happens is she gets distracted by short stories when she should be doing her novel.
Right.
And she just went to her first novel writing workshop, the Story Coast.
That's right. Yeah.
Workshop, and hopefully this will, you know, help spur on the novel part, because she writes great short stories,
yeah,
but it's very difficult to get a book out there.
Right. Well, I mean, I think for me, I mean, I know a lot of great short story writers also. I mean, I'm in my writing group, but...
Your writing group is Altered Fluid. As are many of the guests on this show.
Right.
And the writing group doesn't help, because the writing group is mostly... analyzing short stories.
Right.
And yet, a lot of good novels have come out of the people
in
that group, including yourself and Matt Kressel, and of course, N.K. Jemisin,
yeah,
who is, you know, one of the premier writers in the Skiffy today,
yeah,
I think.
Yeah, I mean, we now have a large number of us have novels out, but I've always felt more comfortable with novels than with short stories. And like I said, short stories... I have a bunch published now, but like I'm still trying to wrap my head around how that form works best for me.
Mm-hmm.
And so it was easy for me to put short stories aside to focus on the novels. And up until recently, I hadn't written a short story in at least a year, if not close to two. So, I mean, I think I'd worked on a few things, but it was mostly old stuff that I was trying to, you know, polish up. And a couple months ago, I wrote my first short story in a long time, and it was good. And it was nice to have. That's the nice one of the nice things about being in the writers group is that there's always that venue of saying, you know, one, being exposed to other people working on short fiction, and then if you do decide to pick one up or you know write one, there's a place to kind of get instant feedback. So I think
it's also good for honing the craft.
Yeah. Oh, definitely. But the thing is, while working on the novel, I barely attended a lot of our meetings just because it was, you know, between work and working on the novel, I didn't have the time to spare for that. So so it was nice to go back to short stories. And I have a bunch of ideas that came to me in over the last year that I'm working on that I think I did learn. They're very different forms, but I think I learned somehow internalized some things about just writing in general from working on this novel. And so hopefully that will inform my short story writing. But also I feel like, you know, people go through phases, and I feel like I'm entering a new phase in terms of the things I want to write about. So I'm hoping that, you know, in the next few months I'll have some things out there, at least on submission, being submitted to magazines and anthologies and And yeah, so hopefully. But then I have the next novel to also work on. So there's always lots of stuff going on at this point. So.
Yeah, that's good. And who knows? It could lead to a paid career.
That's
a dream.
Great, right?
That's a dream.
And you know, these days it's interesting because I think obviously another dream is to have something become a media project. Obviously, like we were talking about Game of Thrones and how that completely changes everything. And again, it's a small percentage of people who ever get to that point. But
and yet, with the advent of streaming media and YouTube era and all that, and digital filmmaking, there's greater access to being able to film and create stories.
Definitely. And I mean, I don't know if this is an actual fact, but it seems like the appetite for genre fiction or like changing that, you know, you mentioned American Gods, we talked about Game of Thrones, like a lot of these properties.
That would have been unthinkable 10 years
right.
ago.
Right, and they're being, you know, made into television shows and movies and, you know, all kinds of different formats. So, I mean, I think, is there some Scalzi's work is being adapted, I believe, or was optioned?
Yeah, well, there's always something that's, everything
right.
gets optioned.
That's true.
It's wonderful. Terry Bisson at one point had like 5 stories that were being optioned every year.
Right.
And he said, I just have to pray that these never get made, and they just keep optioning them. Keep renewing the option and
right.
sending me, and each option was like, you know, well, a five, you know, low 5-digit hunk, $10,000. Something like that, and this is quite a few years ago.
Yeah.
So that, you know, with 5 stories out optioned at once, there was an income on just options.
Yeah, yeah. I mean,
options are great.
But if you're Stephen King, or I guess the ghost of Philip K. Dick, I feel like they keep making movies and TV shows of
Man in a High Castle
stuff.
This
yeah.
Friday.
Yeah,
and that's not the only Phil Dick project this year, I think.
Oh, really? There was...
There's always something.
Yeah, there's always something.
Oh,
right?
Radio Free Albemuth came out earlier this year. Not an independent film project, but one of the most faithful.
Wow, I didn't see
ever.
Yeah.
Not many people did. I had the director on the show,
okay.
And I had a link to it on Vimeo, but I'm pretty sure that it can be Googled and seen online. And now I'm forgetting her name. Famous singer,
Alanis Morissette?
Yes. Alanis Morissette is one of the stars of the movie, believe it or not. And good actors, good people, totally faithful to Philip K. Dick. If it has a problem, it might be that it's perhaps too faithful. Yeah. On the one hand, I dislike things that are just so far away from Phil Dick that they have nothing to do with his universes, and other things that are cleave so closely that you'd have been as well off reading them. I like what Richard Linklater did with A Scanner Darkly.
That's my favorite thing that I've seen, and I feel like I walked out of that theater feeling the way I should after watching a Philip K. Dick based movie, where I, you know, like the something about that squiggly lines, and it gave me a little bit of like paranoia and sort of almost like a drug induced,
yeah. Because the visuals of that movie, like in Waking Life,
yeah,
which is a brilliant piece of work, which ends with a Philip K. Dick pastiche that Dick claimed was real, his epiphany from.
Oh, right, yeah.
Yeah, when everything opens, it's I think it's actually Linklater who does the rap, standing at the pinball machine, talking about that. And it's also in a Weirdo comic. And that's the name of the comic, Weirdo, by R. Crumb, no
right.
less. But anyway, I would like to hear some of your writing read. Should we take a piece of music so you can lubricate?
Sure, that'd be great.
And then... what kind? Let's see. I got a few things on the thumb drive I brought in. Anything from Phil Oaks, here's an unknown band, Piawacket, Natalie Merchant.
Piawacket? Is that the name?
Piawacket, a band I was introduced to by none other than Ellen Kushner, who just gave me this album and said, you will love this.
Sounds good.
And yes, they do. So let's give that a whirl, and we'll be back in about 3.5 minutes. Yeah, you have to sort of whisper the name for those who don't know the name, as I was mentioning to Rajan Khanna, who is our guest this morning. Piawacket is the cat in the play by John Van Druten, Bell, Book, and Candle, that was turned into a mostly good movie. What's good about it is Kim Novak, Jack Lemmon, Elsa Lancaster, and Ernie Kovacs. And all of them are splendid. Unfortunately, James Stewart is totally miscast in the film as the person that that Kim Novak, who is a witch in Greenwich Village, casts a love spell on. And he's just way too stolid. So let's reintroduce the program that you're listening to. It's called Hour of the Wolf. The host that you're listening to is Jim Freund. And as mentioned, the guest is Rajan. I said it right. No.
It's Rajan.
It's Rajan. Geez. Because I call you Raj, as okay. I said earlier. My apologies. Getting people's okay. names wrong, especially on the radio, is a sin. Rajan Khanna. But you can call him Raj, except when you're ordering his books. then you look for the whole name. And Khanna is K-H-A-N-N-A. And the two books are Falling Sky and Rising Tide. I have to be careful with the name of the first book because of the TV series that has a vaguely similar name, which I watched for a couple of seasons before I got bored.
Yeah, I didn't realize how close they were, or how if you Google the name of my book, that TV show will come up more often than not. So.
Yeah, well, poor Jen Brissett wrote a wonderful novel called Elysium.
Mm.
She'll be on the show next month, by the way. Just about the same time that the Matt Damon movie,
yeah,
which is not spectacular,
no,
came out. And if you Google up Elysium, aside from getting the proper definition of the Greek thereafter,
right,
that Elysium represents, the playing fields of Elysium, you get the movie. But now there's the novel, which is just a year old, and the audiobook, which is just available on audible.com and Downpour.com. The official publication date is December 1st. I worked on it. I did the audio editing and helped midwife the project. And for some reason, it's available on Audible like 3 weeks before the people who made it can sell it.
Hmm.
I find that curious. But anyway, when it's officially coming out, let's see. And what's coming up next week on recording? Randy Dawn, then the week after that, Matthew Kressel, and the week after that, Jen Brissett, and
great,
the week after that, the Council of Elrond, and that fills out the year.
It's a good lineup.
Yeah, I'd say so. So, you're going to read for us from the novel.
From the novel, since that's the most recent thing I have. I guess I'll just set it up really quickly for anyone who's unfamiliar with the books. They're post-apocalyptic, so they take place a few generations after a pandemic basically has affected most of the population, and that pandemic is extremely easy to catch. It's transmitted by fluids, but fluids that can be, you know, somebody spits in your eye, that could transmit it. And a portion of the population has moved. Oh, sorry. The pandemic has turns human beings into basically aggressive, violent, hungry animals. So it steals away their reason. They become violent, and so these creatures are called ferals, and they occupy a large part of the ground. And a portion of the population who is not infected has moved up into the sky, living on airships and in two cases floating cities. So the main character Ben is an airship captain who had some adventures in the first book, and his friend Miranda is a scientist who is looking for a cure for the virus. And so I'm going to read a section from the second book where Miranda's being held hostage essentially, and Ben has to go looking for something to fix a battleship. And he was told to go to a Navy base in Washington State, or what's left of Washington State, to try to find one. So I'll just start from there and just read for a little bit. Oh, also, there's a lot of curses in this section, so I'm just going to use the time-honored frack instead of the other word, because it will help me out that way. So.
And a WBAI were against fracking, so.
All right, here we go. They take us to a large outdoor courtyard surrounded by a chain-link fence. I try to take in as much as I can of the base, hoping to describe it later. More guards wait for us in the courtyard, because of course there would be more of those. Is Captain Danning meeting us here, I ask? Then light explodes across my eyes, and it takes a moment to realize that I've been hit in the head. Next thing, I feel a pressure on the back of my knees, and I go down to a kneeling position, landing hard. Something is pulled down over my head and tightened around my neck so that I can't see. Then another blow hits me in the head, and I lose everything for a few moments. When I come back to myself, I'm being dragged backward, someone on either of my arms securely holding me beneath my armpits, My hands are tied or somehow restrained behind my back. Frack, I think to myself. I could struggle, but there's two of them. I can't see, and they're armed. I'm not. And with the way my head feels, I don't even know if I would have my balance. Frack. Then, as I'm running scenarios through my head, I get tossed down onto the ground, and I hear a heavy door close. Frack, frack, frack. I find myself starting to growl, a sound that builds until it's a deep scream, from one cell into another, and all the while Miranda is stuck aboard the Phoenix. This is not how it's supposed to happen, I think. And then I start to laugh. I can't help myself. Great eruptions of laughter bubble up from deep inside of me. Did you really think the world was going to change for you, Ben? It took us a handful of hours to get to Lord Tess, then the rest of the day and the night to get to the base. One whole day used up, and Miranda only has maybe two more. Tick-tock, tick-tock, the water keeps rising. The inside of the bag on my head smells like old sweat, and I try really hard not to think about who wore this last and all the fluids they left on the inside. It's old sweat, I tell myself. Even if infected, the bug would have died out ages ago. I keep telling myself that. And I keep thinking of Miranda, of her aboard Mal's warship, the water getting ever higher. God, Miranda, there's so much we need to talk about. I keep thinking back to that kiss we shared just before I dropped us out of my airship. That kiss that seemed to speak of months of feelings we never acknowledged. I mean, it kind of snuck up on me. I always thought Miranda was pretty, in a sort of earthy, rough-around-the-edges way. She was nice to look at, and I thought that was it. But it seems like something else had been building. First admiration and appreciation, then something more. Now, where are we? What are we to each other? I find that I really want to know, but I need Miranda for that. Think, Ben, think. If nothing else, that should be your mantra from now on. I test my bonds again. They seem to be secure. That makes sense. These people are on a military base. They would have access to good equipment. I scoot back on my butt until I hit the wall and I get myself to my feet. I may be trapped, but I don't need to be a victim. I'm racking my brain for my next move when they come for me. The door clacks and opens, and as I start to speak, my voice muffled by the bag, two people grab me by my armpits and drag me out of the door. For a brief moment, I think about trying to struggle, trying to get lucky and make a break for it. But I can't see, and I'm restrained, and they can and aren't. And I'm guessing they're armed. No, Ben, I tell myself, bide your time for now and hope they're not taking you to an execution. I'm getting really sick of biding my time. They march me down what I'm guessing is a corridor, then around a bend, then into another room. They force me into a chair, two of them holding me down, and with quick practice movements, they release my hands, pull them behind the back of the chair, then latch them up again. Then I hear footsteps recede. A moment later, the bag is pulled away and I blink in the light. A woman, pale-skinned, tall, and wearing a uniform, takes a seat opposite me. Her uniform is different from the others I've seen. More formal, tan in color. There are flecks of color on her collar, some sign of rank, I guess. My name is Captain Danning, she says. I'm in charge here. Well, Captain, I think there's been some kind of misunderstanding here. I came with my friends to ask for your help. Let's have your name first, she says. I sigh. Ben. Ben Gold. Very well, Ben, she says. You say you came here for help. What kind of help? I'm in need of pumps, the kind that keep a ship from taking on water. I realize I don't know what they're called. I was told you had some here. Her eyes narrow. And you expected me to just hand over these pumps to you? No, I say, hoping I sound suitably appalled. I'm not naive enough to expect charity in the sick. We came with barter. Captain Danning tilts her head. Came from where, exactly? I take a breath. I don't know this woman, and she just threw me into a cell, so I'm not exactly inclined to be forthcoming. On the other hand, Miranda. From a ship. Seaworthy? About here is where I would normally clamp down and make her work for the information. But do I really need to protect Mal? And even if she had designs on, say, his ship, should I stand in the way? I care only about Miranda. But something about selling Mal out to this woman feels wrong. Yes, I say, seaworthy, for now. She nods slowly. Ah, I see. So we need replacements. Heard from whom? Sorry? You said you were told that we had pumps. Oh, I nod. Lord Tess, she's a knowledge broker. She waves a hand impatiently. I know the name. Then you know how she operates. I came to her with my problem and she suggested you. I shrug, so I came to try to barter. Danning stands up and starts to pace in front of me, her hands clasped behind her back. I notice she's wearing gloves, strangely bulky gloves compared to her outfit. She starts to nod, once, twice, again and again. I get it. She stops and stares at me. Then, taking me by surprise, she slams a fist into my face. My head snaps to the side, and as I'm still reacting, another blow takes me from the other side, snapping it back right back again. Two more follow. My head is screaming with pain and shock and surprise. She grabs my hair with one gloved hand and pulls my head up so that I'm facing her. Now tell me why you're really here. I'm still reeling from the punches. Things escalated so quickly. I told you, I say, spitting blood. The pumps, that's it. Oh, Ben, she says in utter disappointment. You're going to make this hard, aren't you? I try to catch her eye. I feel blood dripping from my nose and down over my already swelling lips. I'm being straight with you. All I need are pumps. Let's settle on barter and I'll be out of your way. We'll leave. She smiles, but it's a predatory thing. All teeth. I don't think so. Her fist flashes again, and this time I black out for a moment. When I come to, Danning is gone, but the pain remains. What have you gotten yourself into, Ben? And more importantly, how are you going to get yourself out? I'm going to skip ahead here. He's in a chair and he's trying to see if he can break it. I'm starting to form a plan of dragging it to the wall and doing what I can to slam the chair into it when the door opens and someone comes in. This time it's not Danning. A man with dark brown skin introduces himself as Commander Marcus. He also wears a formal uniform, but his looks more cared for than Danning's. Crisp, clean. Likewise his appearance. Not a touch of stubble on his face. His hair neatly trimmed. He doesn't react to my position. Let's start fresh, he says. Just you and me. I nod. Captain Danning, well, she's my commanding officer and all. She's a great soldier and a fine captain. But she has a tendency to be a little hard, he says. It's the pressure of command, you see. Have you ever led? I shake my head. No. It's a difficult job, Marcus says. It's a lot of responsibility. His words drip sympathy, appreciation. So you have to forgive her. I grin at him, and it opens the wounds on my lip, turning the expression into a grimace. Maybe when I can't feel her fists on my face. He shakes his head. We can put a stop to all of this. Get you some bandages. All I want to know is the truth. Then I'll tell Captain Danning, and it will all be okay. Just tell me why you're here. Like I told Captain Danning, I came for the pumps, that's all. And you need these pumps because you have a ship out there? One that's operational. Yeah. What's her name? The ship? Yes, he says, as if I'm an idiot. The Phoenix. He frowns. That doesn't sound like any naval ship I've heard of. I don't know, she was probably renamed. Names don't always keep in the sick. What kind of ship? I don't fracking know, I say. It's big, it floats, it has a big back end. And yet you came from there. I lick some blood from my lips. I'm what you would call a recent arrival. He nods, pacing in front of me. His face is thoughtful. Then he stops, looks down at me calmly, and kicks me in the stomach. I gasp with fresh pain, and he continues to kick. My chest, my shoulders, my stomach, my thighs. He avoids my head. I grunt and yell as each kick adds a new star of pain to the constellation that's lighting up inside of me. As if he doesn't want to damage me too much. Makes sense. I can't talk if I'm dead. A broken rib or two, fine, but no more. I repeat the truth again and again. Eventually he gets tired and moves off. I lay there and pant and moan, and I think about what I'm going to do to him if I ever get the chance. And through it all I see Miranda, tied to the same pipes I was, waist deep in the cold, dirty water, the water rising every hour. Tick-tock, tick-tock. What do you think, more or is that good?
I would say more, except for the fact that we're actually got about 6 minutes
that's,
left.
Yeah, so, okay.
Yeah.
That's where I'll end.
That was a nice bit there. Now, we're a proper two-hour show. let's see, I could have played Miranda by Phil Oakes, Come to Me in My Airship, the Natalie Merchant version, or the 1911 version that Rick Bowes turned me on to.
Wow.
I've learned never to I played Natalie Merchant's song, which is where I knew it from first. And Rick goes, oh, yes, it was an old Irish song from Boston, 1911.
Wow.
Oh, you know, please, Rick. Really? I go home, and I look it up, and there it is. Do not anybody ever question Rick Bowes' facts. He has a lot of them.
Too, yes.
Oh, yes, he's full of them. He really is. And it's frightening. And what was the third song I was thinking of? There's possibly Zombie Jamboree, which nobody remembers from my, but that was from my youth. Chad Mitchell Trio did a great version. Harry Belafonte did one too.
Oh wow!
So, there were a number that I might have followed it up with, but I suggest to listeners follow it up with Getting the Book. Both of them, actually.
Yeah, I would suggest reading the first book first, since I was told by a friend that his wife read them in reverse order, and she seemed to still like them, but Falling Sky is probably best to read before Rising Tide.
Yeah, I mean, they do stand alone, but one sets up the other.
Yeah, and I mean, the hope is that, you know, once the third book is done, that it will be a complete arc, so following, several of the characters through their various circumstances.
Yeah. But it's, you wouldn't use the T word, trilogy, or would you?
I mean, not really, but I think I have been spoiled by trilogies growing up in the sense that it's easy to break stories down into sort of three parts, or, you know, even just a three-act kind of structure.
Well, I like that it's three acts.
And honestly, I think also Star Wars helped inform my idea of, you know, from those three movies, just even the middle part being Empire Strikes Back and how, you know, things get worse and horrible for everyone involved. So that might give you a hint as to the second book of my
story. Are you, well, and that was, well, I'll have this discussion next week because I had it yesterday about Quantum of Solace.
It's like you're time traveling.
Well, yeah, but yeah, well, I mentioned that too. But Quantum of Solace, I see it as book part two of a trilogy, of a three-part story. But then the person who created parts one and two, Paul Haggis, never got to finish part three.
Right. Interesting. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I think.
And if people want to know why, read a book called Going Clear by Lawrence Wright.
Oh, that's right.
And that they never mentioned James Bond in there. But just know that the main subject of the book, Paul Haggis, it was the person who made Casino Royale and Quantum of Solace.
Yeah.
And then all of a sudden, for some reason, wasn't welcome doing the third film of his storyline.
Well, it's interesting because I did an article about Bond recently, and I was going through and looking at what people were judging as the best and worst Bond movies, and Quantum of Solace is at the bottom of so many lists, and I think
it's not at the bottom of mine.
Yeah, no, I think it's a smart movie, and Aliyah Don Johnson, who's in my writing group as well.
She's still in Mexico.
Yeah. But we had a discussion about this a while ago, and talking about how smart it is, possibly a little bit too smart for a James Bond movie in some ways, and that you know the big issue is water. Water rights in
that's
that
right.
movie, and it's actually like a more realistic take on things than
it's water, you know, and going through the fire.
Yeah,
at the end of the film, it's very symbolic.
Yeah, but I guess it didn't really hit with audiences. So
because, well, as I say, I see it as that bottoming out of a trilogy.
Yeah,
and I think that's what it was supposed to do, and that the third story, which would be the rebirth of Bond, because that's what it's supposed to be. Remember, Casino Royale is his second assignment ever.
Right.
That's a reboot. When Daniel Craig starts out in Casino Royale, that's his second assignment as a 00.
Right.
As it is in the novel, by the way.
Right, which I think is the best of the novels.
Mm-hmm. I would agree with that. But I'm a weird person. I also liked the first movie called Casino Royale, which is probably one of the worst films
Woody
ever
Allen,
made. Woody Allen and David Niven and John Paul Belmondo and everybody in the world. John Huston plays M. It had six directors because one would get fired after the other, and it was finished off by Val Lewton, who's a very curious director himself. And Woody Allen wrote the finale.
Oh, wow.
And plays ultimately the evil lord as Little Jimmy Bond. And it's hilarious. It's one of Woody Allen's earliest funny things. And it's, you know, people who go see, the Austin Powers. Austin Powers doesn't get it. There's no reason to go retro. Go for the real thing. You want a psychedelic 60s Bond film, Casino Royale has it all. And I recommend That's Inebriation. For that. We should do a Bond show.
Yeah, I would love that.
We should get a whole bunch of Bond people. Randy Dawn and Dan Persons, who does our movie reviews. And she wrote a thing on Bond for the, I think it's the Today Show website. And
yeah, that would be great.
I haven't even seen Spectre yet. I know all the spoilers.
I need to see it. But also,
it's not gotten rave reviews.
There's a
saw it, Lister? And what did you think? Yeah, exactly. Everybody watching their radio, it's a funny hand going, eh.
I still need to see it. But there's also a Canadian anthology out that isn't released here for legal reasons, but it's basically stories about James Bond, sort of like...
They're unlicensed?
They're
unlicensed
I think that's what it's called. I can't remember what it's called, but it's called something like that. And Jeffrey Ford has a story in there.
Ooh,
and a number of other people.
I'd love to read a Jeffrey Ford take on Bond.
Yeah, I think I saw him post on Facebook today. It's set in Cuba, and it's kind of like a riff on Empire and things like that.
Mm. So. And there's also Anthony Horowitz.
Oh, yeah.
Wrote the latest official James Bond book, and he did the TV series Foyle's War, and a lot. He's a very good writer. I like him a great deal. Well, he's had his miscues as well. And speaking of miscues, we are theoretically out of time. I still have a 2-hour show brain, I'm sorry to say, and so we're just going to have to do this again, hopefully before book 3
that'd be great.
Comes out. In the meantime, you have a website, a blog, a place where people can find out all about you?
I do have a website that I don't update often enough, but it's www.rajankhanna.com. And I'm on Twitter. It's at @rajanyk. Those are probably the two best places to find me.
Okay, very good. And in bookstores.
And in bookstores. Falling Sky and Rising Tide, available now from all major bookstores.
Okay. So thank you for being here again.
Thank you so much for having me back.
And we will do this again. And thank you all for listening. This has been Hour of the Wolf. My name is Jim Freund. There is an hourwolf.com, but it's probably best to use that for emailing me or for finding out about the reading series. I don't keep it up to date. But there's a Facebook group for Hour of the Wolf and also for the New York Review of Science Fiction Readings. Find me there. Be good to each other, everybody. Human beings deserve it. And we are all of that, I hope. Well, some aliens too. All that. Stay tuned for Burn Baby Burn Clapper with Lister coming your way in, but moments from now. Good morning and take care. We'll be right back.
said with the last words on my lips. Now I am a revolutionary. And you're going to have to keep on saying that. You're going to have to say that I am a proletarian. I am
the best. The red, white, and blue spit on you.
Trying to reach my freedom of speech and expressing myself, torturing the symbol of oppression. Let that be a lesson to those that want suppression of the truth. Put on hold, the bold lose control, so they force obedience. Have you pledge allegiance to a piece of cloth that's off the way I see it? Well, I'm going off berserk, cause the system work to jerk. My people, the people, all around the pigs lurk. Tell me I'm wrong, though that's my right, and it's right in the Constitution. Yo, that's an illusion, huh? Suckers trying to change and rearrange. They say that I'm free, but they sure have a strange way of showing it. But I'm blowing the cover. The red, white, the blue, but the black for the brother. And I'm the lover of this flag like many others take the same turn like me. They yearn for the flag too.
Just a mother. You gave me freedom of speech in the First Amendment. So I Bang, sink, and list alive right here. Burn, baby, burn the red, white, and blue right here. Globalizing the burning of the imperialist red, white, and blue right here at 99 Sync of WBAI. List alive. Sapa. 99 Sync of list alive. Burn, baby, burn, y'all. K-Hand, this is for you.
Dans les mains, si vous
oui. Ça va. Burn, baby, burn.
Jimmy Roy, nous j'fais Milan. Jimmy Roy, ne garde Milan. Jimmy Roy, ne j'capitan. Jimmy Roy, ne j'den Milan. Pour tout pan. Jino, chagwe Milan. Jino, peut j'chose j'chan. Gami, mokachi, un citadan. Juste j'y guardi à tout tratan. Pour tout pan.
Le push got then got you them bash that two pan. The hot wind when I'm in my nigga two pan. To turn the bomb and all the DJ shall we on. Chichi han man, the big man, Chichi two pan. My chichi wani mish the mucha got two pan. My chichi wani min wa shika we two pan. We ha me chidin po kiss no titi man. Um bang and put that then got you two tan. Chichi two pan.
Chichi min wa du shpe mi lan. Chichi min wa ne gade mi lan. Chichi min wa mish ta bi tan. Chino pëgjë den mi dan, ku i të man. Chino shagwe mi dan. Chino pëgjë të gjë shan. Kemi mu ga gjë unë si ta dan. Kës përgjë gwa ga gjë ta dan, ku i të man. Që më ndo në cende, qin mu qan që dan. Që që wat një në mështë më nëash që guan. Qin ka hin që ti mu më në do mo jan. Që që në që wat që jan, ku i të man. Qua dhe ngës po që guan, ish pëndin është të guan. Ish pësh ka me që jan, ish pësh me qma men mat. Ish po që guan den dejt na se kam më nëa. Chuja wa wi chi 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 ka min wan tu pan. Chi min wan us pen mi dan. Chi min wan ne ga den mi dan. Chi min wan me shtag wi dan. Chi no chu den mi dan tu tu pan. Chi no shag wen mi dan. Chi no pe chto di shan. Ka mi mu ga chi un si ta dan. Ke se chi guan ga tu ta dan tu tu pan. Chi ka I shin chi chi cha mi nu yan. Chi ka hin chi chi no squi sta di shan. Chi ka chu Chino ya chichi an, mi nan tam ne ne bayan ku tu dan. Kisu chi guan bani hut ka ut de man. Un chao tu de chichi nu pi gun chi shan. Ich na guri bun chi mu chang chi chu den dan. Chi kai tu de ya tu no.
The push got in got you the bash that do man. The hog when the men about in man, they got do man. To train them by Manuadi, did you show we on? Did you hand man to be man, push it to man? But you check one in my stomach, you got do man. But you check one in my rush, you got we do man. We're having chicken, but guess no seat to man, no man, but that they got you do not and put it to man.
Jimmy Radu's friend, me on. Jimmy Radu got them, me on. Chino mish tabi dan, chino pëgjë den mi dan, ku i të pan. Chino shagwe mi dan, chino pëgjë të gjë shan. Kami mu ka gjë u si ta dan, jështë që gwa ka gjë ta dan, ku i të pan. Chimi rwa du shpen mi dan, chimi rwa ne ga den mi dan. Chimi rwa mish tabi dan, chino pëgjë den mi dan, ku i të pan. Chino shagwe mi dan. Chino pëtë të gjë shan. Kami mu ka gjë u si ta dan. Kështë në që kuan ka gjë ta dan. Ku i të pan. Ku i të pan. Ku i të pan. Nas ku i të pan. Ku i të pan.
List Alive 99 Sync. Baby burn, à toi ta go.
Equilibrio frágil, la situación difícil. No puedes con candela que te puedes quemar. Equilibrio frágil, la situación difícil. La vida no es tan fácil, puedes perder o ganar. Equilibrio frágil, la situación difícil. Camina con cuidado, te vas a perder. Equilibrio frágil, la situación difícil. Cuidado, cuidado, cuidado. Que te puedes.
comme dans une mauvaise fiction. Dans leur quotidien, trop d'exclusion, trop de pression. Un jour ou l'autre, ils se laissent glisser vers le fond. Ici-bas, la vie, mon frère, n'est pas couleur au tombeau. On ne te fait pas de cadeau, ce n'est pas la télévision. Ici-bas, le trouvail, tout le monde le sait. Que ce sont pas des cités dans les couloirs de l'Elysée. Tout le monde se croit fort, tout le monde se croit invincible. Tu fonces droit dans le décor, ta folie ne tient qu'à un fil. L'équilibre est fragile, la situation difficile. No puedes con candela, que te puedes quemar. L'équilibre est fragile, la situation difficile. La vida no es tan fácil, puedes perder. L'équilibre est fragile, la situation difficile. Camina con cuidado, te vas a perder. L'équilibre est fragile, la situation difficile. Cuidado, cuidado, cuidado. Je vis dans un monde où la réalité se mêle à la fiction. Les gens vivent leurs rêves et leur vie par procuration. Le bonheur s'achète à crédit, pour ça tu dois payer le prix. Cela ne fait que renforcer la frustration, la jalousie. Les politiciens nous vendent les bienfaits de la civilisation, mais leur pouvoir repose sur la misère et l'exploitation. Les guerres c'est money, les alliances c'est money. Les armes et la drogue c'est money, la forêt est un business qui paye. Tout le monde se croit fort, tout le monde se croit invincible. On fonce droit dans le décor, la folie ne tient qu'à un fil. L'équilibre est fragile, la situation difficile. No puedes con candela, que te puedes quemar. L'équilibre est fragile, la situation difficile. La vida no es tan fácil, puedes perder o ganar. L'équilibre est fragile, la situation difficile. Camina con cuidado, te vas a perder. L'équilibre est fragile, la situation difficile. Cuidado, cuidado, cuidado. Et pourtant je garde encore l'espoir. Et pourtant j'espère qu'un jour nous sortirons de ce cauchemar. Je crois dans les yeux de cet enfant qui sourit. Je crois dans la vibration qui fait grandir les esprits. Et pourtant je garde encore l'espoir. Et pourtant j'espère qu'un jour nous sortirons de ce cauchemar. Je crois dans les yeux de cet enfant qui sourit. Je crois dans la vibration qui fait grandir les esprits. L'équilibre est fragile, la situation difficile. No puedes con candela, que te puedes quemar. L'équilibre est fragile, la situation difficile.